This is SciPod, the podcast of New Scientist magazine.
Find out what's new. What's new?
Chemistry.
Botany.
Evolution.
Information technology.
Cosmology.
Mathematics. Ecology.
Oceanography.
Planetary science.
Medicine.
Biotechnology.
Astronomy.
Welcome to SciPod, the weekly podcast of New Scientist magazine, and your audio guide to the latest news in science and technology. Hello, I'm Bill Oxley. This week in the March 17th edition of SciPod, Minds Apart. Does the language you speak dictate the way your brain thinks? Lies, damn lies, and the hockey stick. The scientific grudge match at the heart of global warming. And from Mars to Easter Island to the exercise wheel, we'll keep on the move with this week's science news. But first, what can the way we talk reveal about the way we think? Dan Everett has been asking that question, and the answer he's come up with could completely change our understanding of language, culture, and the human brain. Everett is a linguistic anthropologist who specializes in the Pitahá, a remote tribe in the Brazilian Amazon. And as he told Ivan Semenek this week, the Pitahá have a language like no other in the world.
Dr. Everett, I want to start by asking you about the world of the Pitahá. This is a rainforest culture. Can you briefly describe what life is like for the people in that culture?
They're basically a hunting and gathering culture. In recent years, they've added some agriculture to their activities. But by and large, the day for the women is spent gathering fruit and nuts and in the jungle. Also, going to their fields to get manioc. The men spend most of every day fishing and occasionally hunting, although fish is a far more important part of their diet. And so they spend most of their day looking for food.
So it's obviously a very different world from the one most Westerners are familiar with. You're one of the few outsiders to speak the Pitahá language. In what way is that language different from the languages spoken by most of the rest of the world?
It's different in a number of ways in terms of the pronunciation, because there are only three vowels and eight consonants and two tones. The words are longer, and they sound more like singing than those of us who speak a language like English, which doesn't have tones, would be used to. It's also very different in that there are just certain things that we can't talk about in Pitahá, because the way we would talk about them would violate the Pitahá culture.
So that's a very curious idea. What sorts of things are you not able to speak about in the Pitahá language?
The Pitahá don't talk about things which go beyond their day-to-day experiences. So talking to them about or things that they haven't seen or I haven't seen. So if I start to talk to them about history of my culture or their culture, it doesn't make much sense to them, because if I haven't seen it, I don't really have any business talking about it in their cultural value system. So if I tell them that Americans have walked on the moon, which is actually a question they asked me because Brazilians told them that, they want to know if I've seen it and which American did it. And if I can't tell them the name of the person that was there as though I had met and talked to that person personally, this doesn't interest them. So, in a sense, they're the ultimate empiricists.
And, Dr. Everett, I understand that even a concept as fundamental or seemingly fundamental as number is dealt with very differently in the Pitahá language.
Right. The Pitahá lack any numerals. They don't have words even for one, two, or three, just for small or relatively larger quantities. It's interesting how we Westerners, think that numbers are so vital to our negotiations around the everyday world. But in fact, the Pitahá show us that you can get by just fine without numbers. Somebody have asked me, well, don't mothers know how many children they have? Well, of course, the mothers know when all their children are present because they know them all by name. But no, they don't know that they have five or six children. They just know when Johnny, Susie, and Billy are there. So the fact that the Pitahá lack numbers is also a cultural value, and it doesn't seem to result in any significant impediment in their day-to-day lives.
So, Dr. Everett, do you think that this language difference, that this extreme of a language difference, reflects a difference in the way a Pitahan's mind works?
I don't think that there really are significant cognitive implications for this. I believe that the implications are severe for the way that their grammar is organized. I think it's unlike a lot of other grammars, and it leads me to the view that their grammar has, in a sense, their language has evolved to fit a particular cultural niche. But a Pitaha taken outside the Pitaha culture, and I've actually seen this happen, and raised among, for example, Brazilians, would develop with completely normal cognitive abilities. This is really a matter of cultural values and doesn't imply or follow from any cognitive limitations.
So then why do you think that this difference would arise here with these particular people in this location?
I believe that, the thing that originally led me to start thinking about this, I mean, first there were all these oddities of the grammar and the language and the culture, things that it was missing, things it didn't have, like numbers and culture words and the lack of embedded clauses and this sort of thing. But then I was trying to think of what the unifying theme might be, if indeed there was something to unify it, and I realized and went to investigate further a concept that's very important in the culture, which is to come in and out of experience, and there's a special word for that, hibit-pi. And that word refers to something that's leaving experience or coming into experience. And by focusing on that as a positive beginning and realizing how important experience was, going through texts and finding out that nothing in any text talks about things that are beyond immediate experience of at least the teller or the person that told it to the teller, I began to understand that immediate experience could play a role in explaining some of these other gaps, these other kinds of unusual facts about the language.
So then, as you say, if they're cognitively no different from everyone else, what is the source of that difference? I mean, it sounds as though, as you say, they're the ultimate empiricists. They're not abstracting or generalizing experiences. I mean, what does that imply about their language?
It simply implies that there are values that they hold about not talking about things which violate immediate experience that are very unusual for other cultures. The written record of the Pitaha about the Pitaha goes back in patchy sources for almost 300 years, and the Catholic missions that began working with the Pitaha in the 1700s abandoned them very quickly as the most difficult group to reach of all the Amazon, in fact, of all Brazil. Protestant missions that have tried to work there as well have abandoned them. And part of the reason for that is you can't talk to them about God if God goes beyond immediate experience. And so there's really no place in their culture for a supreme being that you can't see. They do have a number of spirits that they claim to have immediate contact with, but this value of theirs seems to go back as far as the record we have stretches.
Well, it sounds like the perfect defense against religious conversion.
There certainly is very little chance that any Pitaha is going to convert to any known religion anytime in the near future.
No, I think there have been other cases in the past, and I don't know, maybe these are apocryphal cases where people have said or claimed that certain languages lack certain key concepts like time or number. I think, isn't it true that there are skeptics of those claims? And I'm wondering if you've encountered skepticism and how you would answer those skeptics.
Well, of course, I've encountered a tremendous amount of skepticism, and I think the skeptics are entirely reasonable. It's extremely difficult to prove the absence of something. It's much easier to prove that something exists. So it's always possible for people to say, Dan just didn't look hard enough. If he looks harder, he'll find those things. So one of the things we're undertaking is that there's a 3-year project now from the European Union that involves myself and a number of researchers from Europe, in particular Germany and Scotland and Holland, that will over the next 3 years, among other things, be investigating and conducting experiments on my claims regarding the Pitaha, and we'll be doing a number of experiments that should show whether, in fact, I'm correct, or if I am correct, what the cognitive implications are. And these sorts of tests have to be done. Nobody should change their way of doing business in the scientific world just because of a report of one lone researcher, although I think that these experiments are going to be very important and establish the significance of Pitaha for our theories of human language.
Dr. Everett, thank you very much. It was wonderful to speak with you today. I'm not sure, but is there a Pitaha word for goodbye?
Chisotwa.
I'm not even going to try, but I really appreciate the time. Thanks very much.
Sure, you're welcome. Bye-bye.
Dan Everett is a visiting scientist at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology. We reached him in Leipzig, Germany. You can find out more about his 28 years of studying the Pitahā and their unusual language in this week's edition of New Scientist magazine.
Because you're curious about the latest in science and technology news, we bring you SciPod.
Now, here's Jeff Whittle and Donna Page with this week's science news.
The atmosphere of Mars is so thin, it's nearly a vacuum. But new evidence shows that in the distant past, it was once as thick or even thicker than the atmosphere of Earth. Scientists at the Open University in Milton Keynes analyze meteorites that are known to have originated on Mars. The presence of carbonate minerals in those meteorites reveals how much carbon dioxide was in the Martian atmosphere when the meteorites formed. The results show that billions of years ago, the CO2 pressure at the Martian surface was between 2.3 and 2.6 times Earth's current air pressure at sea level. The meteorites also reveal that by 670 million years ago, Mars had changed dramatically. At that time, its surface pressure was a mere 1% of Earth's, and it's continued to drop since then.
Nail down your cat flaps. Domestic cats are at a higher risk of catching avian flu than previously thought. Recently, health officials in Austria announced that 3 out of 40 cats tested positive for the bird flu in their saliva. The cats were all living at an animal shelter that also housed infected birds. In the past, cats have been known to contract the virus after eating birds with avian flu, but in this case, they must have picked it up by different means, possibly from bird feces. None of the cats at the shelter exhibited symptoms of bird flu, and scientists say it's too early to know if cats with such mild infections can pass the virus on to humans. Even so, hundreds of cats have been left at animal shelters in France and Germany over the past week by people afraid of bird flu.
With its giant stone statues and deforested landscape, Easter Island has long been a symbol of the dangers an organized society faces when it exhausts the environment that sustains it. Now, researchers working at a number of sites on the island say this story could be completely wrong. Although it's clear that human colonization had a rapid and detrimental impact on the island's palm forests, the ecological record shows that islanders replaced the palms with viable crops that included sweet potato, taro, banana, and sugarcane. In fact, the loss of trees does not appear to have triggered any kind of agricultural crisis, and there's no clear evidence of a population collapse before Europeans arrived in 1772. Now, some researchers say it's more likely that European diseases and slavery are the real reasons why Easter Island's native population all but disappeared.
And finally, it seems that loneliness is not a good thing for anyone who wants to enjoy the benefits of regular exercise. That's the conclusion suggested by an experiment at Princeton University, where psychologists used rats to study the interplay of stress and companionship during exercise. During the experiment, some rats were housed in small groups, while others were kept alone. Half of all of the rats were allowed a daily workout on an exercise wheel, while the others got no exercise. After 12 days, researchers measured the development of neurons in the rats' brains. Not surprisingly, the rats that got more exercise showed more development. That's because exercise is known to stimulate brain cell growth. But the rats that exercised in groups showed even more development than those that exercised alone. Researchers say that's because exercise also releases a stress hormone, which inhibits growth. The rats that exercised together experienced less stress and so got more out of their workouts. Ironically, the result shows that getting caught up in the rat race is actually not such a bad idea.
We hope you're enjoying this week's edition of SciPod, and we'd love to know what you think of our podcast. If you've got a comment or suggestion, please drop us a line. Just email your feedback to podcasts@newscientist.com. And now, back to our show. It's called the hockey stick graph. It's a 1,000-year record of average global temperature that, for the most part, is flat. That is until you get to the 20th century when the graph suddenly angles upward, like the blade of a hockey stick. 5 years ago, the hockey stick graph was elevated to iconic status by the United Nations Panel on Climate Change. Since then, it's been a lightning rod for attacks, both from inside and outside the scientific community. And if you're trying to understand how politics and science collide around the issue of global warming, then sooner or later you'll run into the hockey stick debate. Fred Pierce covers climate science for New Scientist magazine, and this week he explores what has become a very interesting grudge match.
Fred, let's start with this infamous graph. It's shaped like a hockey stick. It tells us that the Earth is heating up. Where did the graph come from?
It came from a guy called Mike Mann, who was at the University of Virginia at the time, back in the late 1990s. He was concerned that we really didn't have a proper plot of the history of global temperature. While we had quite a lot of data from tree rings and coral isotopic analysis and so on, seabed sediments, which were kind of proxy data for temperatures, nobody'd ever put it all together to come up with a global overview. And that's what he attempted to do with some colleagues, and it was a pretty pioneering effort.
And what has the impact of that graph been on climate science and I guess on the broader public awareness of global warming?
Oh, it hit pretty hard. What happened is it was published in 1998, which was the warmest year of over the last 150 years for which we have an instrumental record. So pretty soon people, because the hockey stick was suggesting that the 20th century was the warmest century for the last 1,000 years, pretty soon people were saying 1998 was the warmest year for a millennium. And, of course, that got people going. I mean, the climate change community saw this as clear evidence of global warming. But the skeptics rather thought that the science of this might be a little flaky, and they were determined to attack it and to use it, I think, as a weapon to attack some of the wider nostrums of global warming.
Now, I think some of our listeners might even remember those headlines from 1998, and it's easy to see how maybe someone with a political agenda or reason for denying climate change would not be a fan of this graph. But as you're suggesting, the graph has actually been attacked on scientific grounds. So what's the source of that scientific controversy?
I think there have been two attacks on it, both of which are perfectly reasonable, among the science community, because, new pieces of research have to be investigated in great detail, and scientists have to see if they can be replicated, if the findings can be found with other similar studies. So what happened, there were two assaults, one of which was on the statistical techniques used to collect up and categorize the data from all these various proxy sources, such as tree rings. So that was a rather detailed technical debate about the statistics. And then there was another argument really about the reliability of some of this data, whether you really can assess properly temperature trends from tree rings, whether the data got contaminated by things like changing rainfall or changing carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere, those kinds of things. So really there was a question of the reliability of the raw data and the question of what the statistical techniques being used and how correct they were. So there was, there's a fair old ferment. I mean, there was an awful lot to discuss. Perhaps the problem with it was that, normally scientists would discuss this in a fairly friendly atmosphere, and they'd be to and fro, and some people would write critical papers, and there'd be responses. And eventually kind of things would settle down to an agreed story. But this got highly politicized because it, as I said, it was being used as a way of attacking the whole climate change agenda and the climate science in general. So quite a lot of outsiders got involved in it. And while that's not bad in its sense, it rather polarized the debate.
It certainly seems like a tall order, doesn't it, to be looking back over 1,000 years. There's really no one place on Earth you could go to for 1,000 years of temperature history, so you could see how that would invite various kinds of criticism. How does Mann address some of those critics, sort of on specific terms?
Mann has had a rough ride. I mean, I think, a lot of people have gone after Mann. I mean, I've met him and, interviewed him and emailed him and so on, and he's a pretty tough character, and he doesn't back off. So he comes, if they criticized him for taking shortcuts, as they would have put it, in putting together his 1,000-year time series, he came back with a 2,000-year time series to prove the same point. So he comes back hard and he fights. And some people in Congress and in Senate took him on by demanding to see his details of his techniques, by demanding to see information about who'd ever funded his research, wanted to see his computer programs. So many people in the science community, the National Academy of Sciences and elsewhere, thought that there was a kind of witch hunt going on here and have been rather critical some of the demands being made on man, and regarded those as really kind of not part of the normal and proper scientific discourse.
So that's the political side of the debate. Now, do you think any of this, Fred, undercuts the scientific basis for global warming?
I don't think any of this does undercut the scientific basis for global warming. The argument about global warming doesn't really hang on the detail of exactly what the history of climate change has been in, or the history of climate has been in the last millennium. We know that there have been shifts and variations and oscillations in global climate. Things have got cooler and warmer and wetter and drier. That's just part of a natural natural variability. It would be foolish of climate change scientists to say that there wasn't natural variability, because there clearly has been. So to say that, you know, even if the 11th century did turn out to have been warmer than the 20th century, I don't think that would alter the basic argument that we now, today, are warming up the planet through our emission of greenhouse gases.
And as far as Mike Mann goes and his assorted critics, I mean, what's the status of the debate today? Is there a winner? Is it a stalemate? How would you describe it?
I think after a couple of rocky years, Mike Mann can now see that he's onto a winner. I think he sees he's in the home straight, and I think he's quite right. All science, however good the original research and however nicely written the paper and however persuasively it's argued, no scientific findings matter a damn until they've been replicated. And that's what's been happening since Mike Mann produced his first paper back in 1998. People have gone back over the stuff, they've replicated it, they've changed the data sets, they've said, well, let's not use that set of tree ring data, let's use another set of tree ring data, let's take data from China rather than the US, let's take Europe, let's leave stuff out, let's put it in, let's change the statistical techniques. And they all broadly come up with the same thing. They all broadly find this crude hockey stick shape.
Well, Fred, thanks very much for telling us about this. Have you ever seen a hockey game?
Yeah, I have. But over in Europe, we don't play ice hockey so much as we don't have so much ice, I guess, in winter. We play regular hockey out on a green soccer pitch. I've seen that a lot, and I think the shape of the stick is much the same as for ice hockey.
And I think the game is a lot more like climate science than people might at first think.
Oh, it's vicious. It's real vicious.
Well, that's great, Fred. Thanks again.
Okay.
Author and journalist Fred Pierce spoke to us from London. You can find his feature story about the great hockey stick debate in this week's issue of New Scientist magazine.
Subscribe to New Scientist magazine, and every week you'll enjoy a comprehensive roundup of the latest science and technology news, along with a listing of the best science jobs from around the world. Subscribe today, and you'll save 40% off our annual price, and get unlimited free access to the entire content of NewScientist.com. To take advantage of this offer, just visit NewScientist.com/2504. That's NewScientist.com/2504 for this week's best ideas delivered right to your door.
Well, that just about wraps up this week's edition of SciPod, but it's only the beginning of what you can find in the March 18th edition of New Scientist magazine. Also in this week's issue, The Hole in the Heart of Gravity. We go in a search for the essence of attraction. Screen Test. Controversies and lawsuits erupt over the genetic testing of the unborn. Saved by Sand. A new technology stops bleeding on the battlefield in seconds, and it could be headed for a first aid kit near you. All this, plus lots more science and technology news, features, and opinion. Remember, only New Scientist brings you the week's best ideas. I'm Bill Oxley. Join us next week and find out what's new on SciPod.
Mission Control. SciPod Transmission. Concluded.